Welcome today to our interview series with outstanding professionals. I'm Stephen Agraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Bruce Cowper, a top international security authority and chief security advisor, Microsoft Canada. Bruce, thank you for coming in today to share your deep insights with the audience and continuing this interview.
Absolutely, my pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
Bruce, you know, we talked about many things so far in terms of your role as a chief security advisor and the different paths you've taken and how you got into security, and you've given us some great tips in terms of authentication and protocol design, network security, and also some roadmap level sort of lessons involving security. I'd like to continue on in this discussion to talk about the industry now. And you know, we know the industry is changing. What advice would you give to IT professionals to stay on top of what is happening in the industry in order to position themselves and their organization to benefit from these trends?
Well, I think part of it comes down to how people get information and exchange ideas and what have you. For me, I always find one of the biggest and most important areas is the sort of community that you work in. Part of that, I think, is really making sure that we have a number of people's perspectives on it. So a couple of good examples. There is so much technology out there that if I was sitting down and essentially trying to solve a security challenge, I really want to be able to ask the questions about how other people are using this technology, the types of experiences that they're having. And that's one of the things really that you get from the community and sort of building those relationships. So I would say one of the biggest things is to get people to participate in their local or sort of other security communities. The second thing is very much to also get them to share their ideas. I think a lot of people look at coming forth and saying, okay, well, this is my perspective on this particular security challenge or this particular approach, and the fear that they may that somebody else may sort of shoot them down. In reality, I don't find that in the security world, because of the fact that it's such a dynamic field. One of the things that we always try and encourage people to do within the local user groups and what have you is to share their perspectives and make sure that they have an opportunity to have their say. Because what we find is that the way it works for one person may be different from the way it works for another, may be different again. And so I would say making sure that people participate, but also sort of participate proactively, not just sort of absorb information. And the other big thing that I think about from sort of changes in sort of career for me, which have led to where I've got to today, is a lot about sort of taking the chance. The challenge, I think, is that security is still a little bit seen as one of those areas of sort of almost a black art in many cases. But what I'm seeing is a lot of people adding security as another string to their bow, as another skill set to their existing portfolio, and being able to sort of understand perhaps the bigger picture within security, understand how security applies to their world. And so I would certainly advise people, if they are thinking about sort of where they're going and what they're doing, security becomes a great way to sort of add skills, but also really does help the business as we look at how security gets integrated into what we're doing.
So do you have any recommendations as to kinds of the key linkages to help enhance a person's career, or you know, either through relationships or different kinds of resources to help enhance their careers?
So security is still as much about who you know as what you know. And part of the who you know is making sure that you get the right information at the right time to help you deal with sort of security challenges or sort of be in the right place at the right time to further your career. So, I mean, for me, one of the big things was going and reaching out to local user groups to local industry associations that have groups within the area, and making sure that I was involved with them. Another big part to it is that there are an amazing amount of free or sort of relatively inexpensive training courses that are very often being offered by whether it's vendors like Microsoft or organizations like sort of ISC Squared or sort of plenty of others. And what I found was that just participating in those, especially in a two-way conversation, was incredibly useful for my learning curve as well as sort of the career opportunities that were out there.
Chris, what are the five most important or three most important broader IT and business challenges and solutions in 2009?
So I would say that probably number one is going to be the convergence of technologies. So part of it is that there are so many instances where things like consumer-based technologies are appearing within the enterprise. That doesn't mean just mean things like hardware. That can also be things like the use of social networking sites from within the corporate environment. I mean, part of the challenge there is that we have an inherent level of trust with some of the sites and some of the connections that we're using. In that, for example, a social networking site, I've signed up with a username and password. I log into it with that username and password, and I control perhaps who can see the information I post and those that I interact with. And so there is an inherent level of trust from individuals within sites like that or tools like that. But that goes beyond the scope of normal corporate IT security, for example. They have no control necessarily of sort of what you're saying, how you're saying it, the applications in many cases that you may be using on your machine, which may impact the corporate security. And so because of the use of non-enterprise software and sites within the corporate environment, the use of non-enterprise hardware within the environment, becomes really hard for corporate IT environments to really keep control of security and really control that and maintain that within their organization. I think the next big thing that we're going to really start to see is a lot more of the sophisticated attacks. So we see a big shift, for example, from things like email as the main transport mechanism for things like malicious software and phishing attacks and social engineering attacks, towards really targeting the application layer and the users themselves, and especially through things like web-based communications. Now, part of the challenge with that is we have traditionally focused on areas like email and others, that there are a lot of tools out there to help us deal with things like junk mail and sort of mail filtering, etc. But in the web-based world, it becomes perhaps more of a challenge because it's a new area that may not be covered by our existing security solutions. And so I certainly see a lot of the shift in attacks, especially using the web-based platforms, as being difficult for a lot of IT departments to keep control of. The other big thing that I'm really starting to see as a trend, I mean, there are some new threats that are really coming to the fore. Things like virtualization security is now vastly being talked about. A couple of years ago, I spoke at a conference on virtualization, and I had requested at the time to speak on security, and I was told, well, hang on a minute, the market hasn't got to the level of maturity that people are understanding exactly what they're doing with their virtualization approach, let alone going down the security path. And I argued at the time that this is absolutely the right time as people make those decisions as to which path they should be following, and essentially security management and some of the other tools become absolutely part of the conversation and decision-making factors in deciding sort of which path and which technologies to go down. And so I see a lot of those where people, if people start thinking about security earlier on in the life cycle or decision-making process, certainly not only helps them save time, but in many cases a lot of effort and money later on in helping them deal with security, because a lot of the tools and technologies are sort of integrated into their approach. And so over and above that, I think one of the big things that we should think about from a security perspective, as I mentioned before, is almost getting people to sort of stop and take a more holistic approach. And part of that is driven by the fact that we've traditionally purchased or invested in things like point-in-time security solutions. Whereas right now, I'm seeing a shift towards people understanding that one of the biggest challenges in security is actually how you manage and maintain information, machines, people's user IDs, etc., across their life cycle. And so almost stepping back and looking at how they sort of implement security through things like the management tools that they invest in. And I would certainly say that the last area as well is when we look at things like compliancy. I see a big shift within compliancy and the compliancy field towards implementing the right security management and other solutions with the end goal of solving those challenges, then almost looking at compliancy as, and what are the incremental steps, or what do we need to get out of our security solution, maybe from an auditing perspective or others, to be able to then achieve that compliancy. And so I think that organizations that sometimes perhaps beat themselves over the head with compliancy, almost implement IT policies, technology investment because of the compliancy. And I see that most of the successful solutions are where compliancy comes as a result of them solving business challenges.
Now, if you take that prior question and apply it to the next 3 to 5 years, what do you see sort of looking in a broader way further into the future?
Well, I see that customers asking for, and people asking for, things like integrated security solutions, auditing solutions, and essentially much easier ways of finding out my current security posture is really starting to drive the industry in terms of software vendors especially. So some great examples. We look at product sets from Microsoft and Symantec and McAfee and all sorts of other vendors around the world. And where a lot of them are focusing on is bringing a lot of the technologies together. So really three big things. Number one is making sure that the technology actually works together with the other technologies they have. So we see a lot of leveraging of standards. We see a lot of integration between not only their products but third-party products. And I think that's incredibly important, especially from a security perspective, so that people get that perhaps holistic view back to them. The second thing is we start to see an awful lot of companies investing in things like dashboards. Really, it's about how we present things like the information that we're gathering. I've seen a lot of both small and large vendors really starting to concentrate on how they present that information to the various teams within an organization. And I think as we sort of, over the next few years, we'll start to really see a lot of emphasis being put onto the analytics side, being put onto the display and reporting mechanisms of a lot of technology and a lot of solutions to really help people understand exactly what's happening today, where they sort of go in the future, and sort of the impact that perhaps even changes will make on the system. And I think that the last big area that we that I'm really seeing over the next few years is a huge emphasis on security being built in rather than bolted on. Part of that is that, A, it's much cheaper and more effective for an organization to really deal with security challenges through an integrated process. And where I start to see organizations really succeed is when they go down essentially and look at their own maturity of their infrastructure, of their processes within their organization. So it starts off at the sort of basic levels where people are understanding what they have. Now, those may be as simple as the security assets or the assets that they need to help secure. It may be the hardware. It may be the information that they're on the network, have on the network. But understanding exactly what they have today. The next level is really when they start rationalizing that. We see, and I start to see a lot of customers going through and planning over the next few years how they approach things like standardized deployments. A lot of the argument that gets given to me is, well, if we can build security right in from the initial deployment, we know it's built into the software, we know it's the tools are available, it really helps us to know that when we put a machine out there or we activate an account or we publish a service, that it starts off from a known working point. And of course, then we start to look at how we integrate the tools. And I think this is where the huge growth area is going to be over the next few years, both in terms of vendors producing new tools, but also in terms of services opportunities for IT companies to then help people essentially get the most out of their systems through the reporting mechanisms, the compliancy dashboards, the alerting systems, and really making sure that those are sort of part of the day-to-day infrastructure and, as I mentioned earlier, not necessarily a bolt-on solution. So I think that the shift over the next few years is really going to be around things like the integration, the management, and the whole holistic view.
Well, Bruce, you know, you provided a sort of a rich sort of series of dialogues in terms of things that we can do and lessons and security tips and so forth. I have a series of kind of areas that I'd like to explore in more detail and where you can share maybe some of your key lessons and experiences. For example, and there's a sort of a litany of sentences here or areas that I want to explore. So I just want to bring that up ahead of time. But the first one is sort of understanding the classic Orange Book approach to security and its limitations. What are your thoughts on that?
So one of the things that I always look at, no matter what, whether you're using the Orange Book or whether you're using any of the industry guidelines that are out there, is really understanding that they are exactly that. They're guidelines. Because of the way we categorize security and the risks to our particular organizations or even specific challenges within our industries, what I always try and get people to do is to realize that the Orange Books and things like the other standards that are out there are really information that has been put together by other organizations based on their experiences and their requirements to help give you a guide. They're all worthwhile reading in terms of understanding perhaps other areas that you may not have considered, but at the end of the day, that none of them will provide you with a complete prescriptive manual on how you go and do. The Orange Book is a classic example whereby it was put together with some very specific criteria and purposes in mind. And in real terms, a lot of what may apply to one organization in there may not apply to another.
How about the whole topic of operating system security tools and structures? And can you provide some examples, let's say, from the Windows area or perhaps even the open source area?
Well, the great thing that's happened over the last sort of few years is because of the greater emphasis on security, all of the vendors or groups, whether they be sort of open source focused or not, have started to put an emphasis on making sure that things like the platform is fundamentally secure. Also adding in a series of controls. So when I start to look at, say, the operating systems, you very rarely will find an operating system that doesn't now come with a firewall. An operating system that you probably won't find an operating system that doesn't have a mechanism for secure authentication. And in many cases, what we've seen is the bar having been raised that much higher by the demands of the customers. There's some other interesting shifts that I'm seeing as well with things like centralized management. And these come under the general security approach that, for example, if I have things like firewalls, I have web browsers, I have other tools on top of built into the operating system and installed on top of, I need to manage and maintain those. I need to be able to do patch management. I need to be able to sort of control things like updates within my environment. And so what we've seen is is all of the vendors really stepping up to the plate and starting to enable that sort of functionality. Part of the opportunity, I think, for the industry is to now really start looking at things like the controls that we have for some of the more user-centric attacks. There's very, very few operating systems out there that can't be locked down to a good security point. They generally have a lot of tools built in that enable you to do that pretty effectively. A good example was the CanSec West last year, where essentially the Windows-based operating system with Vista Service Pack 1. We then had Ubuntu. We then had the Mac OS that were all put up against a series of attacks. And in each case, it was not the operating system that essentially led to a compromise. It was the applications or the user interaction that was the challenge. So we're starting to see a lot of new tools being built into the operating systems and the applications, like the anti-phishing filters being built into web browsers, the privacy settings now being integrated into the web browsers. We see a lot of sandboxing of applications within the web browsers so that the user does accidentally click on the button that says to install that particular piece of malicious software, perhaps without being aware of it, there are safeguards in place. And so a lot of those safeguards come from the way that organizations layer security and the security tools. So we see, for example, in the Windows world, that you get, if you look at sort of the perimeter of the machine, obviously the firewall is the sort of the first point of call. Then you get things like the anti-spyware tools, that are designed to sort of monitor the system on an ongoing basis. Then you get tools like user account control, which is really designed from a Windows perspective to intercept administrative functions. And the same thing actually is found in the Mac OS. And so what we're seeing is a lot more of the layers of security like that being integrated.
You know, you've actually talked about the networking side, the web and the wireless technologies, but sort of working them in combination, how do you see them affecting security?
Well, what a lot of organizations are doing is leveraging that sort of layered approach where essentially the sort of the holy grail becomes being able to access the information and the resources from wherever you are, on any device, at any time. And so what we see is a lot of vendors and organizations really looking at it and saying, okay, well, what are all of the the connection mechanisms, what are all of the possible scenarios, and starting to bring all of the technologies together to say, well, maybe for a particular user, primary connection mechanism is going to be across the internet in terms of web pages. So our first layer of defense becomes the browser itself. Then, of course, they're probably going to be using the application. So it becomes the application layer security, whether that's through things like the filtering mechanisms at the application layer, or things like the anti-spyware tools, sandboxing, and all sorts of others. And so that becomes the next layer. Then, of course, protecting other applications from being impacted in case of things like a security breach, or protecting the data itself. And so I think all of those come together very much to take a much more layered approach.
How would you see this working with things like identifying software security defects, from buffer overflows to development process flaws?
Well, that's an interesting part of the conversation. I mean, I think over the last couple of years, the industry has got a lot better in both finding its own security bugs and sort of releasing updates, but also working with the security industry and the researchers out there who are also finding some of the same challenges. We find that most of the vendors are now being much more upfront and honest and open about the types of challenges and the sort of the vulnerabilities, et cetera, that are out there, and releasing patches and updates to sort of help deal with that. And I think that's an incredibly important part of the process, because the vast majority of organizations have concentrated very much on the operating systems themselves as being the sort of first and best line of defense. Having said that, because we see a lot of the attacks shifting to the application layer, that's where it becomes not just the problem of the OS vendors, but it becomes the problem of everybody who's producing a piece of software to deal with security within their application. And what we've certainly found is that it becomes very much a decision-making, or part of the decision-making process for customers as they start to deploy the software, to turn around and say, okay, how does this organization do patch management? How do they help me get updates onto the workstations? And so we see, especially all of the larger vendors, really stepping up to the plate and saying, right, now we need to provide open mechanisms, with a realization that it may not necessarily be all, say, Microsoft technology, or all a different vendor's technology on the system, that we actually have to provide much more open mechanisms.
So, Bruce, we're continuing again with this sort of series of areas that we're sort of exploring in more detail. And we talked about Orange Book and operating systems, and also about the web and wireless and so forth, and software defects. I'd like to now explore this whole idea of using best practice techniques for authenticating people on computer systems and diverse settings. So what can you talk, what can you say about that whole area?
Certainly, one of the things to consider whenever you're authenticating people is really around, especially in sort of diverse settings and what have you, is around things like the credentials that they're using. Now, one of the conversations that we're having right now within the industry is looking at the number of digital identities and the validity of those digital identities. And a lot of that comes down to people who are maybe issuing digital identities, or traceability, or essentially trust. So, for example, when you are doing business with the Government of Canada, they have a mechanism for being able to issue you with a digital identity, which you then can use for things like your tax returns and other sort of ways of interacting with the government. Now, we have a level of trust with those digital identities in that there are a series of checks that we and balances that we have to go through to be able to get the issued the digital identity. That then the issuer, as in maybe the government of Canada, has a level of trust that they've done due diligence in providing that identity. However, if you take that out of that specific criteria, what about all of the other identities that we have that we both create and are also issued, and how much trust do we have with those? And so when we start looking at especially things like privacy and the information that we have to provide to essentially get hold of those digital identities, or use them for authentication, a lot of the questions become, should we or do we need to share some of the PII, the personal private information that we do right now, and what's the value of that PII? So a great example is the social insurance number will be one of the primary things that the Government of Canada will use to reference who we are when they issue that identity. What happens if that number has been made readily available, perhaps to other people from a security breach? And so part of the conversation is, how do we essentially devalue the PII to the point where, just having my social insurance number compromised becomes less of an issue to me, to also being able to leverage the other identities that we have out there. And part of this is driven by the fact that we have so many digital identities that it makes it very hard in many cases for us to keep up with them or indeed store them correctly or manage them effectively. So there's some interesting things that we're really looking at within the industry, and that's how we leverage things like standards for digital identities, how we look at issuing of identities, who is issuing, and what are the criteria they're using to be able to make the claim about the identity itself. And so when we start to talk about identities and especially authentication within a very broad sense, especially within sort of diverse settings, what we're really trying to do as an industry is perhaps start to get to the point where we can rationalize the use of those identities to understand essentially what their value is and sort of how they can be used for different activities. So a great example may be if you're authenticating against, say, a banking website. So if I present an identity which is a username or password, the bank may turn around and say, okay, well, that's given me essentially one piece of the puzzle. So based on what you've given me, I know that there is a reasonable level of trust that allows you to do perhaps certain transactions and certain value of transactions. The next step may be, well, if you're presenting me with your username and password, that's one thing, but I now also know that you're coming from a machine that you use on a regular basis. And so being able to understand that, well, the next level is you've got a machine that you use on a regular basis, perhaps I can even start to understand the status of that machine. So is that machine up to date? Is it patched? Does it have running antivirus software and the other tools that you would expect to see? In which case, based on the next level of information, change the level of transaction that individual can do. Or perhaps even, I know that you're connecting from a public machine, and therefore I'm going to sort of assume that there's a greater level of security that's required. And so what we're really starting to look at is how organizations understand the use of identities for the different, especially in a diverse set of scenarios, to help really provide a level of trust from the person that you're interacting with to the organization at the back end.
Then this sort of leads to this whole idea of validation and standards and testing to enhance confidence in a system security. What are some of your key lessons in that area?
So we get asked all of the time when we're dealing with organizations, especially that have a heightened level of security requirements, so what are the standards that you comply with? And that's a very positive thing along the lines of it shows due diligence from the vendor's perspective or from the individual's perspective that they have gone through the testing, that they've gone through the due diligence and perhaps the accreditation processes. I think part of the challenge is that we see a lot of the security breaches out there being essentially generated through things like misconfiguration and what have you. But if you know that, for example, the technology that you're deploying has been through various sort of criteria of research, of testing, and sort of does give you that enhanced level of confidence, one of the things to consider is that you also need to essentially make sure that what you are doing to that operating system, that application, that process, also doesn't detract from that level of confidence. So I see it as a very positive step forward where organizations are demanding things like, has it been through the Common Criteria certification, or has this been tested by third parties? Just to make sure that at the end of the day, that you start off from a known state.
There's a lot of desktop productivity tools. I mean, really, virtually every desktop has them, right? And people use them on a continuing basis. So how does this impact things like security, privacy, and trust, and all the sort of the challenges associated with those areas? What are your experiences in this area and your key lessons?
Well, certainly part of it is that as the use of the productivity tools sort of becomes essentially ubiquitous and new tools come onto the market, what we need to make sure is that they are essentially sort of managed and maintained and what have you in the most appropriate way. Now, the reason I mention that is that certainly as we find a lot of the productivity tools become ubiquitous, I think there's a couple of considerations. One is that the more widely used a tool, the more a target it often becomes in terms of if somebody wants to go after a particular vendor or a particular tool, normally for things like monetary gain, etc., that becomes a bit more of a target. The other sort of factor to consider is a lot of these tools are becoming sort of very integrated and make it very easy for people to do things like collaborate and sort of share information. A lot of the focus, for example, for the whole sort of web 2.0 is about sort of rich communication and collaboration. And so a lot of the productivity tools that we're seeing right now have the ability to enable that communication and collaboration with sort of other people and other systems. The challenges, well, certainly I think that we need to be aware of the mechanisms that those use for collaboration. So, for example, having the ability to create a blog post and sort of post that from within Word is a really useful function for the consumer or for the end user. But what are the implications around sort of security and privacy? Other good examples where we look at standards around things like document formats, understanding the types of embedded information that's included within those document formats is incredibly important from a security standpoint to understand exactly what's being communicated. And so really when we start to think of the ubiquitousness of a lot of the desktop productivity tools, we need to understand exactly what those tools can actually do, how we can manage and maintain them across their life cycles, in terms of perhaps information, what is being produced by those tools, and how are we managing and maintaining that information, securing the information across its life cycle. And so at the end of the day is making sure that we have things like a good level of trust that essentially there are no surprises under the covers, and that from a vendor's perspective, us needing to sort of help organizations that are out there with things like the management, the maintenance, and other areas becomes really important to maintain that level of trust.
So I just want to remind the audience here that we're sort of drilling down to some topic areas involved in different security issues and exploring, you know, what are the ramifications of these areas. So we're going to continue in this series here. We're almost near the end. The next sort of question in the series would be, you know, Bruce, what are your sort of key lessons and experiences associated with digital rights management, watermarking, information hiding, and policy expression?
That's an interesting area that seems to have sort of become a big part of sort of people's lives. When we start to look at, for example, how do I protect the information that I'm creating, or how do I essentially make sure that, say, as an artist or as an organization, that I can understand things like the integrity of that information. And we're starting to see a lot of approaches towards digital rights management, perhaps more from an enterprise perspective. So whether it be with organizations that are essentially selling information, whether that's video, whether that's music, whether that's documents, making sure that those documents can't be copied, etc., or can only be sort of played back on sort of licensed technology. What we're seeing is a lot of those organizations taking the feedback of their customers, and where we get a lot of the convergence of devices. So, for example, being able to take that same piece of audio and not just play it on my PC or my machine that I've downloaded it on, but play that on my portable device, then perhaps take that and play it on other types of devices, where we get the convergence of the technologies there, we start to see a lot of organizations really looking at the user experience and the portability of that information. And so it becomes actually a pretty hard one when you're talking about things like full digital rights management, because as a vendor, what you're wanting to do is to help provide a mechanism for, say, a content provider to be able to enforce the digital rights management across the different tools that you provide. But on the flip side of that is giving enough flexibility to the user to make sure that they can access and play and leverage that that content across the different platforms. What I think is really going to happen with that is that we'll start to see an awful lot more usage of, as things like movies and TV in general and other media suddenly becomes based on the internet, is a lot more use of things like embedding of watermarks, embedding of the digital identities into that information, but also more use of things like standards to help people use those in a very portable fashion.
Now, Bruce, you talked about this or touched on it, and this whole idea of the interface or the interaction with the user. So, you know, there's a lot of developers in the audience, and, you know, they have to develop with security in mind, but let's approach it now from the human-computer interaction standpoint and that design, the user experience. What are some principles there that we should be mindful of in terms of security?
Well, we've certainly seen over the years that if we very often use draconian security practices, people will often find a way around them. So I was recently having a conversation with a large government entity that has a lot of controls around things like document formats and document portability, etc. And what they discovered was that people would often transport these documents outside of the controls that they had put in place. And so we see that time and again where humans will look at potential barriers and figure out a way around them. So what we try and encourage people to do is as they're implementing things like security policies to control maybe document flow, information management, is to look at specifically what are all the user experiences and potentially the sort of bypasses that the user may put in place. I think part of the challenge is that very often we're wanting to sort of protect both the users and, say, the computers on the systems. What we're seeing is a big shift towards protecting the information itself and turning around and realizing that the information essentially is part of the lifeblood of the organization. And therefore, at the end of the day, if I don't protect that across its life cycle, I have a big challenge. So in other words, if I use technologies like encryption and others that are very straightforward or preferably seamless in the background for the users to leverage, they're more likely to use it. And especially if, say, things like rights management within a document then propagates across to different systems so that the user experience is A, seamless, and B, as similar as possible across the different platforms, it suddenly makes it a lot easier for the users to understand and accept things like the security practices that we put in place. And if we use security then as an enabler for people, all of a sudden it becomes a lot simpler for them to adhere to the policies that we put in place. So many of the failures that I've seen within the security world have been because the user experience has not been taken into account when implementing security policies and technologies and procedures, and ultimately those being breached or bypassed in some way by the users. So that's an incredibly important component.
So, Bruce, this is the last of sort of these drill-down questions. What are your viewpoints then on the potential of emerging work in hardware-based security and trusted computing?
This is an area that has been around for quite a while, but is really starting to come to the fore. And we see a lot of this driven by some of the sort of challenges that are out there. So I'll give you some examples. So if we look at the trusted platform module chips that we find in most corporate laptops these days. This is something that's really only come about in the last few years, where, for example, if we're wanting to use encrypted volumes or we're wanting to essentially tie data, information, people to the physical hardware to a certain extent, we've now got a mechanism or a level of trust within the hardware for things like identifiers, offloading things like encryption and other mechanisms. Also things like encrypted USB keys is another great example where there's perhaps a realization on the one hand that people are going to use things like USB storage devices to store and transport data. And the second part of that is the probability is perhaps greater with this type of device that it might get lost or stolen or compromised in some way. So if we think about using the embedded hardware encryption and making it completely seamless for the user, as we sort of talked about in the last section, it suddenly becomes a lot easier to essentially take the decision out of the hands of the user and really sort of focus on perhaps mitigating a particular security risk. So certainly with the emerging work in the hardware-based security and sort of the trusted platform, trusted computing, what we're seeing is an awful lot of mechanisms to try and sort of put mitigations in place, especially from the user perspective that are seamless, but also perhaps more importantly that are manageable and trusted by the organizations that are implementing them.
So thank you, Bruce, for providing those deep insights into these sort of drill-down questions. I'm going to, again, broaden it out now. In terms of your current role, what do you see as the biggest challenges in their solutions, and how does this relate to business?
So within my current role, I spend a lot of time essentially looking at the the sort of security decision-making processes within organizations. And as part of that, I think there are a number of big areas that give our perhaps greatest concern, but give the sort of the biggest opportunity for organizations. I mean, starting at the base level of the training and awareness and education components for users and sort of people involved in the security parts is certainly very, very important. And one of the things that I always look at in my role is how can I put the right resources, get people the right level of training, make sure there's the right level of understanding around the latest security practices. And so I think that training component is very, very important. Now, when I'm looking at a lot of organizations, they're very often asking for very specific information around individual technologies to help them deal with current perceived security threats. Now, that's a very important thing, but what I often find is that they perhaps don't know the bigger picture in terms of how they fit together. A couple of great examples that I've come across recently. So within a particular organization, they were looking towards something as simple or something specific as being able to lock down USB devices and the types of USB devices that were connected into an organization. And so really working with them to understand what it was that they were trying to achieve was actually pointed out that it wasn't the USB devices. That was a symptom of the challenge that they were having. What they were really looking to do was essentially to protect their information during transit and to try and control the types of places that the data could be stored. And so What I try and do is really get people to sort of go away from just what is the feature functionality of the technology and to really understand what the sort of the business drivers were and the security challenges associated with those business drivers. I think from my perspective in my role, certainly understanding what is out there and what is happening in the security world and helping the people I interact with becomes incredibly important, because at the end of the day there are, as I mentioned earlier, an never-moving set of goalposts, so it becomes very, very hard to sort of keep up with that, and that then becomes my role, is to help people keep on top of security practices.
Earlier, Bruce, we talked about some of the broader IT business challenges and solutions in 2009 and building up in the next 3 to 5 years. We also talked about some of the trends in terms of roadmap-level tips involving security. Do you have any additional predictions to make about future IT business trends and their implications and opportunities?
I think that there are a few others that I didn't mention earlier. One of the areas of growth from a security perspective that we're starting to see is around things like gaming. Now, gaming has been a traditional an area that has perhaps transcended things like businesses and what have you, by virtue of the fact that ultimately we're all consumers. The gaming industry has really been trying to broaden the types of people and numbers of people who are involved in gaming. And by doing so, what they've often added to it, the experience, is the online connection and the online collaboration. We see it with things like Live on the Xbox platform, and we see it on various others. The challenge for a lot of individuals and organizations is that very often the games and gaming consoles and other types of devices aren't managed and maintained in the same way that we would do a physical computer. We've started to see, in a lot of cases, malicious software and other malware coming out that are targeting games specifically, because essentially, with many of the online games, you're subject to the security that's built into the game that you're using, rather than having control of it. And so, what I think we will start to see is a lot more of the attacks that we find leveled against the consumers, especially starting to leverage games and gaming consoles and other leisure pursuits to sort of for their aims.
Bruce, you provided us with so much information. Now, what do you see as the top recommended resources and why?
Actually, as I mentioned earlier, for me, the biggest resource that I use are the people around me. I spend a lot of time in and around the sort of security community to be able to answer or ask the questions and have them answered about, so what do you see coming down the pipe? What are you doing? How are you doing it? And what is your experience? So certainly the people becomes incredibly important. I actually also spend a lot of time reading things like newspaper reports from around the world. So a couple of good examples are that quite often when we're looking at how security challenges are approached, I like to understand what is happening in sort of different countries in terms of, if we start to look at things like privacy. We know that Europe is generally very hot on privacy, and so I actually spend a lot of time reading sort of the European newspapers, even things like the BBC and others, to try and get more of an international perspective. We're often influenced within Canada, especially by what's happening sort of south of the border. And there are some very different approaches that Canada takes from the United States, but there's also a lot of lessons that can be learned and shared. And so what I quite often will try and do there as well is keep abreast of some of the international, keep abreast of some of the U.S. media, Wall Street Journal and others, to sort of help me. However, the biggest resource that I would say that I have available are the blogs. What I've found is that if you want to have a two-way conversation, the blogs and the blog sphere has suddenly enabled us to ask questions and actually have our say. For example, one of the resources that I put together last year was about some of the Microsoft blogs, and it was focused more on what are the ways in which you can communicate with the product teams directly so that it's a bi-directional conversation rather than you actually just absorbing information from the regular sources like the media, etc. And so I found that things like TechNet blogs and MSDN blogs to be incredibly useful resources. But don't also forget a lot of the third-party blogs, and the way I generally find those is by reaching out to the people around me and saying, hey, I'm interested in this topic. Has anybody seen some really useful information? And I find that the blogs, in a broader sense, become incredibly useful for that.
I guess this touches on your point again, though. You talked about the task group and other community groups. So where do you find these resources when you want to ask people questions or find what are the blogs they recommend? I guess you have to join community groups.
That's right, and I found that as being by far the most successful mechanism, because it's less about me sort of going to a search engine and typing in the keywords, and more being able to ask the question, so what are the resources that you use?
You know, Bruce, you're quite a noted security authority and really globally. Do you have any others that you would recommend?
In many cases, I follow the blogs of people like Mark Rusinovich, Stephen Toulouse, and those are both obviously Microsoft people. But it's interesting to go and sort of follow the some of the conversations that are being that are happening around the world. Now, one of the things that I often do is attend conferences, whether it be Sector or others, and actually go up to the speakers at the end of the session and say, "So, what's your blog?" And that gives me a way to sort of listen to the speaker, understand what they're saying, and then keep communication with them.
Bruce, you've just provided just an amazing set of coverage in terms of all the different areas of security. Are there any other areas or topic areas that you want to provide additional commentary on, or maybe even put it in another way? If you were doing this interview, what one or two or three questions would you ask, and then what would be your answers?
So I would say that one of the top questions that I always ask people is really to sort of step outside of their area of comfort and look at some of the other sort of challenges that they're having and some of the impact that they can have on the world. So a good example is when we talk about things like online safety or other areas, what I try and encourage people to do is to essentially make a stand and do things themselves. And so I always ask people, so what is it that you do to try and make the community around you a better place? Because I think part of the challenge is that it's easy for us to essentially bury our heads, and it becomes perhaps somebody else's problem. And so, I mean, for me, I spend a lot of time within the community, as we've talked about a number of times. But I also spend a lot of time volunteering to provide things like the sort of knowledge transfer that we've been doing today, but also to try and sort of provide practical assistance to people. And when we talk about things like online safety, one of the biggest challenges out there is the technology gap perception, where a lot of people assume that because they're not necessarily familiar with the technology, they will have a problem online or there is an issue with sort of their safety on, say, the internet. What I try and do is sort of almost turn it back and look at things like what are the contexts that they can understand. For example, fraud, whether it be online or on the high street, is still fraud. Bullying, whether it's in the playground or online, is still bullying. And areas like that I feel that I can try and sort of use my knowledge and sort of expertise or sort of physical ability to be able to help with. And I think that's an area that always amazes me with the number of people that do volunteer their time and their energy and their knowledge and expertise to sort of helping those around them. But it's also a great way when you consider from a career perspective to be able to change the sort of who you are and sort of get recognition and notice for the way that you help other people.
Bruce, there's this UN-founded International Federation for Information Processing, or IFIP, and they have their Professional Practice Partnership Program, which received full ratification at the General Assembly in August of 2007, and they began their implementation beginning in October of 2007. In fact, this program is due for full release in 2009. Now, this marks an historical inflection point and speaks to IT as a recognized profession with global standards, a profession-based code of ethics, and widely adopted professional certification. Can you comment on this global initiative?
Well, one of the biggest challenges that I find with, for example, new Canadians is coming in and being able to essentially translate their skills. So in other words, employers understanding what skill sets that new Canadians have and the sort of their experience levels, etc. And when we look at things like security and the IT industry in general for Canada, this is a huge opportunity for national growth. it's also an opportunity that I don't think we're fully capitalizing on yet. And one of the big approaches of the whole IFIP project was being able to rationalize a lot of the information and a lot of the sort of skill sets and a lot of the qualifications out there to help people on the international stage both apply and also understand them. Whenever I speak to Canadian businesses, they look at a lot of international or sort of non-Canadian qualifications and have to apply a translation so that they know what level this person is at. Whenever I speak to a new Canadian coming in, they're unsure, and when I came into Canada, had exactly the same challenge of how do I actually translate my current skill sets, my qualifications, etc., into being readily marketable in Canada. And that's one of the biggest things that this type of approach really helps us with, is being able to understand on a global stage exactly what things like the qualifications and the expertise and the experience actually mean. The other part, it really helps Canada to be able to look at the international stage as an opportunity for things like revenue, for things like employment. And I think that one of the things that Canada has to offer is the ability to get out as a trusted partner on the international stage and really speak the same language when it comes to technology. And from my perspective, that's exactly what the program is trying to achieve.
Bruce, it's been a real pleasure talking with you today, and really this is the end of our podcast series. And we've explored a number of different areas, such as you as a work as a security advisor, how you got into this whole area of security, and we even drilled down into things like authentication and so forth. So we really appreciate the time you spent with us, and you know, we will follow your significant contributions and all of the deep insights as you continue on in your journey as a security advisor, as an international security expert.
Wonderful. Well, thank you very, very much for inviting me along, and I certainly look forward to speaking to you all again.